supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
2 years ago, Philadelphia was sued over its civil forfeiture program, by which local authorities seize homes, cars, and other assets from those suspected of being tied to the drug trade. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. While the city has changed the program, critics say it still has a long way to go. WHYY's Bobby Allen reports the case was back in federal court today.
One-fifth of the budget for the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office comes from selling off seized assets. Darpana Sheth with the Washington-based Institute for Justice found this out after suing the city in 2014.
Philadelphia takes in almost $6 million each year in forfeiture property and then uses that to pay salaries and other equipment for police officers and prosecutors.
For context, that's more than the combined assets seized every year by Los Angeles and Brooklyn combined. The suit did force some changes. Now a court official, not a prosecutor, oversees the hearings, and they were moved from the infamous room 478 in City Hall and into the criminal courthouse. But Sheth told a federal judge that there are still huge problems. For instance, someone who's had a home seized can't challenge it until the trial, and that could take months or years.
And so in the meantime, a lot of innocent people don't have their car that they can get to work. They don't have money that's been seized.
Representatives from the DA's office wouldn't agree to be interviewed after the court hearing, but they say they seize properties to deprive drug dealers of assets and profits. And they say many seizures come after community requests. That's not always the case, Sheth says. Sometimes the homes are only loosely connected to the drug trade.
It's the parents, grandparents, and their house is taken or their car is taken, and they did not do anything wrong.
She says defendants deserve faster hearings and that a judge, not just a court official, should oversee the cases. She's hoping for a trial on whether the practice is constitutional or not sometime this year. For WHYY News, I'm Bobby Allen.
A New Jersey Republican congressman is voicing doubts about his party's bill to overhaul health care. Details from WHYY's Tom McDonald.
Congressman Leonard Lance, a Republican from Hunterdon County, New Jersey, who has a district that stretches across the state, says he's leaning against voting for the GOP health bill.
I do not think the bill would pass in the Senate in its current form, and I do not think that we in the House should be voting on legislation that cannot pass the Senate. I would like to see bipartisan cooperation and cooperation between the House and the Senate as well.
Lance says analysis from the Congressional Budget Office showing millions fewer people would be covered under the Republican plan changed the climate on Capitol Hill. Even though he's known as a fiscal conservative and the plan would help cut the federal deficit, Lance says that by itself isn't enough to get him on board.
Certainly that is a component in the bill that moves in the right direction. I do want to make sure, however, that states that have expanded Medicaid, including New Jersey, have the ability, at least to some extent, to continue to do so.
More than 550,000 more New Jerseyans have coverage because of Medicaid expansion, and right now federal tax dollars pay for most of it.
I'm not sure the federal match can stay at 90% where it is now, but New Jersey expanded Medicaid. This was a bipartisan effort by Governor Christie, a Republican in the democratically controlled legislature, and I think that has been a positive in New Jersey.
The congressman says he's hoping Democrats will participate in the final reform of the system, but Pennsylvania Democratic Senator Bob Casey doesn't sound as if he's willing to join in any compromise.
Well, this is a scheme by extreme Republicans in Congress and the president and his team, and I use that word purposefully because a scheme is an action which is meant to mislead, and I think that's what they're trying to do here.
I'm Tom McDonald, WHYY News.
Former city managing director Rich Nagrin picked up a key endorsement in the race for Philadelphia district attorney today from the union representing Philadelphia police officers. WHYY's Dave Davies reports.
Police endorsements are helpful if you're running for a law enforcement post, and Nagrin now has the backing not only of the Fraternal Order of Police, but also the Guardian Civic League, an association of African-American police officers, as well as Philadelphia's Spanish-American Law Enforcement Association. FOP President John McNesby says his union is ready for a new DA.
And we're going to take our 14,200 members, along with their families, extended families, neighbors, and friends, and we're going to come out and we're going to have a show of force like you've never seen before.
In the Democratic primary race, among seven candidates with little name recognition, all are looking for something to make them stand out. Negrin says he's moved by the support.
Our brave officers risk their lives every single day. The best of them don't just fight crime or respond to crime. They build relationships with the community in a way that prevents crime.
Negrin talked about criminal justice reform and ending mass incarceration, but often in politics, it's relationships as much as policy that matter. McNesby got to know Negrin when he was city managing director.
You know, he's done a lot of things for the families of our fallen officers. It's kept private for a reason. He kept it private, we did, but a lot of good key things behind the scenes. There's not a time, whether it would be in the afternoon or in the middle of the night, that I wouldn't pick up the phone and Rich would answer.
The FOP can now offer more than nice words for Negrin. After a court battle, the union won the right to raise money from its members for political contributions. It can give up to $23,000 to Negrin's campaign. Dave Davies, WHYY News.
Educating physicians in the basics of addiction medicine is the goal when doctors gather at the third annual Addiction Symposium at Jefferson University Hospital 1 week from Saturday. Organized by the Philadelphia Psychiatric Society, among the speakers at the symposium, Dr. Abigail Kay, assistant professor in the Department of Psychiatry, Division of Substance Abuse at Thomas Jefferson Hospital. Dr. Kay, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Thank you.
This symposium is divided up into topics called for the generalist and for the specialist. How is it defined that way?
For the past 2 years, we've had the conference, and it's had basically for the generalist. We've tried to cover the basics of addiction medicine, just because in the past, it's not something that was always taught in medical schools. And what we've done this year is we've partnered up with the Pennsylvania Society for Addiction Medicine to offer an advanced track, which is aimed at people who already have expertise and a background in addiction medicine.
You'll be speaking on this topic. Treatment options for opiate use disorder. Is it a rapidly evolving field?
In many ways, yes, but also in many ways, no. In terms of the medication-assisted treatment, the three forms of medication have been available for over a decade now. Some of them in different forms, but they are not sort of that new that they just developed now.
The one that the lay listener is most familiar with likely is Narcan.
Yeah, and Narcan is a fantastic medication, and it actually comes in different forms. It comes in the form that people use after they've accidentally overdosed to save their life, but it also comes in a pill form, a variation of it, that someone can take every day that blocks opiate. And the benefit of that is if somebody's trying to stay in recovery, by taking it every day, they know that if they try to use opiates that nothing would happen. And it also comes in a longer acting form, which is an injection, which lasts for about a month. And it's a form of medication that can be very helpful for a lot of patients.
In your capacity as a psychiatrist, you also specialize in part on what's called insight-oriented psychotherapy and psychoanalysis.
Yes.
Is there a role for that when treating somebody with addiction disorder?
I think the thing that's really important to remember is, in general, a lot of people who have addiction disorders have severe childhood trauma, and that often plays a role in why they have the addiction. And one of the things that you have to keep in mind is, when they're getting into recovery, things from their past that they've kept buried away for a very long time are now surfacing, and that's something you really have to address.
Where does Philadelphia and Pennsylvania stand in 2017 regarding considering addiction to be a medical disorder rather than a criminal behavior?
I think we're doing fairly well. That is not something that I can speak to as an expert, but what I can say is we certainly do have, for example, we have drug courts where people are given the opportunity, instead of going to jail, to get into treatment instead. And my feeling about it is there's no magical rays in jails that help cure addiction. And so I think it's really wonderful that we have that as an option for people. And I think one of the challenges is addiction is the only illness that is actually a crime, that you can be arrested for having it. And I think that makes it an additional challenge.
Another hat you apparently wear is working with medical students. To what extent are they grounded in this type of awareness, or is the curriculum so busy that they can scarcely get more than an oversight.
So the medical students actually get a very nice education in terms of addiction medicine. So the way the curriculum's actually changing, but in the current curriculum, in the first year, they actually have an intensive week of addiction medicine where full time they're essentially studying addiction medicine. And one of the things that they also have in during that week is we have patients from our clinic come and do a patient panel where they sort of talk about their stories and their history of addiction, and then the students meet with them in small groups. And it's really wonderful how well received that is by the students. I feel like it really helps them appreciate, you know, that these are patients with just yet another illness. And then as they move on into their clinical rotations, we actually have the students rotate during their psychiatry rotation in our methadone programs. And so the students get quite a bit of exposure. Two other treatments for medication management of opiate dependence include methadone and Suboxone, both of which are excellent treatments. And one of the things that I think is really wonderful about the city of Philadelphia is community behavioral health, which is the mental health and addiction carve-out for medical assistance, really provides excellent care for patients who are on medical assistance and makes any of the three treatments a very viable option. And I think that's a really wonderful thing because I think it's often the case that people don't have access to all three treatment forms.
Dr. Kay, thanks for joining us to shed light on NewsWorks tonight.
Thank you. I very much appreciate you taking the time to talk about this important subject.
Dr. Abigail Kay, Assistant Professor of the Department of Psychiatry, Division of Substance Abuse at Thomas Jefferson Hospital. March is tournament time. It's true for college basketball fans. It's also true for Philadelphia's brightest young minds. Last year, the city held its first ever championship for Quiz Bowl, an academic competition pitting school versus school in a battle for trivia supremacy. WHYY's Avi Wolfman-Arendt recently attended Philly's second city Quiz Bowl championship and followed one team's quest for an upset victory.
Wittenberg!
David versus Goliath. It's a theme that comes up a lot this time of year. Usually it's accompanied by screaming fans and blaring bands, but at the Quiz Bowl tournament held at Friends Select School in Center City, David wasn't holding a slingshot or a basketball. Instead, he was fiddling around with a Rubik's Cube. That's William Zhang, a senior at Carver High School of Engineering and Science in North Philadelphia. And he can turn and twist that cube amazingly quickly. When I found him, he was waiting for the Philadelphia tournament to start, and while all the other kids chatted and joked, Zhang alternated between his Rubik's Cube and a series of flashcards. I'd approached him really randomly because I wanted to ask a player about Quiz Bowl, which I'd never seen before, and he seemed like he knew what he was doing.
Who are, like, the strongest teams?
Friends Select is the strongest. And after that, it should be us.
Zhang and his teammates explain the rules to me, and it boils down basically to this. A bunch of really smart kids answer a bunch of really hard questions over and over again.
I kind of like to call us a lovable band of misfits. We are the nerds that don't even fit sometimes with the other nerds.
That's Shan Hogan, a teacher at Carver and the team coach. She loves Quiz Bowl so much that she started her squad in 2013 before Philly even had a tournament. 2 years later, a Penn PhD student named Chris Chiego decided to start a Philly Quiz Bowl League. On Saturday, 18 teams from 10 schools showed up for the second ever championship.
I do think that sometimes we get the people that have this knowledge in their head that might be obscure and random, and it might fit in nowhere else, but it fits in with us, and I think that's sort of the people that end up finding us.
I'd been told that Carver has a strong team, and once the matches began, I realized just how strong they were.
More precisely, a perpetual motion machine cannot exist as this kind of
system. A modulo P, where P must be...
They once used a preservative called binerosol.
It was a blur of big words and buzzers, and Carver was like a trivia tornado blowing through each team in their path. Carver is a selective magnet school, but even against other magnet schools, they stood out. First, they took down a team from Central High School, then it was Masterman. The top schools in the city were no match for the Carver Quartet.
You played really well, right? We need to keep that intensity up, right? So the next match is Rushby.
And as the day wore on, I learned bits and pieces about the Carver team. Su Lee had immigrated from Cambodia. Hassan Talouli's parents fled Palestine when they were young. Muhammad Iman arrived from Bangladesh when he was 10. Muhammad was the team's ace on sports trivia, a subject he'd learned from his grandfather, who was a sports nut.
He used to watch all the Phillies game, the Eagles game, and sometimes hockey. He used to have a radio right next to him every day, and at night you'd hear the Phillies game is on every night.
They were each from a different part of the city and the world, and together they seemed to know everything. By the afternoon, they'd won 9 straight games. Only one opponent was left, Friends Select. Carver had never beaten them, but they'd also never played this well.
But if there's a day to beat them, today is that day,
yeah, today,
right?
That day.
Today is our day.
Friends Select is one of the oldest and most prestigious schools in Philadelphia. Carver's team, meanwhile, had to hold bake sales just to cover the cost of getting to and from tournaments. Of course, the Friends Select kids seemed perfectly nice and may well have overcome their own obstacles, but it was hard to deny the whiff of a Hollywood ending, an underfunded public school up against a private school juggernaut. Could David pull it off?
Second place goes to an amazing day played by Carver A. Very nice.
The short answer was no, they couldn't. As good as Carver had been all day, Friends Select was just that much better, that much quicker, that much sharper. Of course, teenagers can be remarkably resilient. By the time the trophies were handed out, the Carver team was making nerdy inside jokes with their coach.
And you got Flaubert. I was so happy.
You got Flaubert.
He did. Yes. I was so happy. Because remember last time I had been like doing like visuals, being like Flaubert. And nobody got it.
Perhaps the kids had learned something about teamwork or hard work or whatever. Because if the competition was any indication, they already knew everything else. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt, WHYY News.
Across the country, employment in the solar industry went up 25% last year, though employment in the field in New Jersey fell 15%. There are still plenty of projects underway in the Garden State, though a slowdown may be on the way, as WHYY's Phil Gregory explains.
You can see solar panels on many rooftops, utility poles, and fields in New Jersey. There are 66,000 solar installations in the state that generate a combined 2 gigawatts of electricity, and more are being put up.
We're good right there.
A solar field being constructed behind the Delaware Valley Regional High School in Frenchtown is expected to provide 80% of the school's energy needs and save the district more than $800,000 over the next 15 years. Like many solar projects, it's a leasing arrangement. A private company pays for the installation and then sells the power the panels generate to the school, municipality, or homeowner for less than they'd pay to buy electricity from the local utility. Some homeowners or local governments fund the installation themselves. Brick Township Mayor John Ducey says the solar panels that were erected in the parking lot and put on the roof of the municipal building several years ago have cut energy costs $5,000 a year.
It saves us actually having to go out and purchase our power from another source. So a third of it is generated right here at Town Hall, and it doesn't come out of the taxpayers' pockets.
Another solar project in Brick is used by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency as a case study in how contaminated sites can be put to productive use. Assistant Township Planner Tara Paxton says a 7-megawatt solar field located on top of a capped 42-acre landfill has been producing electricity since 2014.
Considering it was a Superfund site and the potential environmental impacts with the plume that's in the water table could have had on the rest of the community, we needed to do something. And rather than just having it sit there and be a capped landfill, it's at least doing something for the future of the township.
The incentive for solar developers in New Jersey is something called SRECs, Solar Renewable Energy Credits. They are tradable commodities, and how much they sell for goes up and down with supply and demand. Lyle Rawlings is the president of Advanced Solar Products and leads the Mid-Atlantic Solar Energy Industries Association. He says the incentive system creates a boom and bust cycle for the industry that may be headed for another collapse.
The demand is set by legislature on a year-by-year basis. So that sets how much you can build without crashing this commodity market. Last year, we built more than the legislature provided for. So we've put ourselves on the brink of another bust cycle.
New Jersey Senate Environment Committee Chairman Bob Smith is pushing legislation that would continue requiring utilities in the state to purchase the solar renewable energy credits, trying to stabilize things.
It advances whatever SRECs are left and moves them up to the next 2 or 3 years so that we maintain the same level. I think that by June 30th, we either will or won't have a bill, and the solar market may or may not be back into boom and bust.
Smith says New Jersey will study different ways of stimulating solar projects. Rawlings says a tariff system used in other states sets a fixed price for the electricity produced by the solar panels. He says that provides predictability and encourages new installations. Environment New Jersey Director Doug O'Malley says more solar development won't just help employment and the state's economy. It'll also reduce air pollution.
You know, solar isn't just kind of a nice gee whiz thing in our homes. It can be the way that we're going to reduce carbon pollution in the state so that we will not have extreme weather events like the ferocity of Hurricane Sandy becoming more and more common here in New Jersey.
Only about 4% of New Jersey's electricity is now produced by the solar industry. Clean energy advocates want 80% to come from solar and other renewable energy sources by the year 2050. From the New Jersey desk, I'm Phil Gregory, WHYY News.
Tom Lehrer, a master of irreverence, wrote cheerful tunes with lyrics that poked fun at establishment values in the 1950s. After watching a musical review of his songs called Tomfoolery at Act Two Playhouse in Ambler, WHYY theater critic Howard Shapiro says Lehrer still lands a good punch.
Like Tom Lehrer's songs, the show Tomfoolery is a wolf masquerading as a sheep. It's harmlessly cute on the outside, with stiletto teeth lurking underneath. The Act Two Playhouse version is delivered by four actors who smile their way through it. From the very beginning, when they sing Lehrer's Ode to Spring on Sunday afternoons.
Oh, the world seems in tune on a spring afternoon when we're poisoning pigeons in the pond. Every Sunday you'll see my sweetheart and me as we poison the pigeons in the pond.
That's Tracy Higgins and Patrick Romano poisoning those pigeons. They're joined by Act Two Playhouse's leader, Tony Braithwaite, who directs Tomfoolery, and Jameson Foreman, who also accompanies the show on keyboard. They do a great job bringing off the biting satire Lehrer amazingly got away with in the 50s and early 60s. At first, he sold recordings of his songs around Cambridge, Massachusetts, where he was a Harvard student studying math. He drew a cult following, then concert audiences, and a record deal. He later got a gig as the resident songwriter for the satirical TV show That Was the Week That Was. Tomfoolery was put together in 1980 by theatrical impresario Cameron McIntosh and others, and it surveys Lehrer's takes on religion, education, the nuclear threat, and mother love, in which Lehrer rhymes Oedipus and platypus. And it works. Most of the songs are short, and some don't even directly address what they're making fun of, including one that ends up being about venereal disease. I got it from Agnes. Here's a recording of Lehrer singing the first part, and then Tony Braithwaite from the Tomfoolery cast.
I got it from Agnes. She got it from Jim. We all agree it must have been Louise who gave it to him.
She got it from Harry, who got it from Marie.
But before he retired from songwriting, Lehrer wrote clever musical numbers about the English language for the children's television workshop show The Electric Company, and that's how younger audiences might know his work, if not him. Act Two Playhouse is using social media to try to get them into Tomfoolery, which is having no trouble finding an audience. It's already been extended a week. If the younger set does show up, they'll find much of Tomfoolery fresh and current. It's at Act Two Playhouse in Ambler through April 2nd. I'm Howard Shapiro for WHYY.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.